We hear the crying of the grifters as the lonely hordes go with them, blaming strife and persecution on profiles with pronouns in them. Hear the kids in cages wailing while they put a ban on vaping, but we've got the very thing to save your soul. I'm Justin Easorio, the debaterio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 8 of the Debaterios podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Oreo, here with my other awesome co-host, SJW Debates. How you doing, man?
I'm doing outstanding. How you doing, Oreo?
I'm doing good. And today, our topic is about the two debates that SJW Debates got into, I think within the span of 1 week, actually. There were two debates he's done. And yep. Let's talk about the first one, which was a debate with a leftist ethno-state supporter or a leftist race realist. How did that go?
That was the most stressful debate I've ever been in my entire life. Man, I have done a few debates in the past. It's something I like doing, but I usually debate people on the right. I usually debate like transphobes or people who hate the woke left or people who don't like LGBT people or who people like, you know, who don't think climate change is real. Those are the type of people that I like to go after. But this was someone who was very much on the left who just had these, imagine something that you genuinely believed in, like a position that you genuinely held and you wanted to see furthered. And now imagine that position being taken by someone else to a place that just warps it to the point where you cannot deal with it. That's what it was like debating this. That's what it was like talking to this. So I'm talking about, her name is Rei Murasame. That's who my debate was against. And man, what did you think of that?
Now, I didn't see the debate live, but I did see, I guess you could call it the little recap, like when you post the debate on YouTube. I liked calling it a recap, but I didn't know what to think because I did see her debate Papa Bird Jake on Twitch. I did see a little bit of that one. I didn't even say the whole way through because one, I was tired, and two, I just felt like she was bullshit, I'm not gonna lie. So when I saw you debate her, I'm like, okay, I have to watch this, but then I missed that one. So then I had to watch the recap and I'm like, man, I don't know what would happen if I watched this live because I probably will flip out in chat. So I'm kind of glad that I didn't watch it live.
For your own mental
health.
Some
of the things that she said just blew my mind. Like her whole stance on Native Americans, which is that Native Americans should have their land back. And the way that we should do that is to deport people who aren't Native American west of the Mississippi. And it's like,
That's why it was so hard. Like the first half of that, like Native Americans have been completely screwed over historically.
Yeah.
We all agree on that.
Mm-hmm.
And the like part 1.5 of that is we should do something to help Native Americans because they are experiencing, you know, super high levels of poverty based on those historical actions, and we should absolutely do something to help. But then she gets to the point where let's deport everybody who's not Native American from west of the Mississippi to, haven't got that far yet. That's all we need to do, though. Just deport everyone who's not Native American from west of the Mississippi. Now,
and it's like the problem she doesn't realize with that is like there are some people who are white, black. I'm not sure about Asian or Hispanic, but I would also count them because there is a possibility.
Yeah, definitely Hispanic.
That do have Native American blood within them, because there is a way to be coming to be a part of a Native American tribe, even though you're not Native American. And that is, you have to have this, I guess, percentage of blood, or you have to have an ancestor who's this close to, I guess, this generation. And if you can determine that, if you have proof of that, then you can be a part of this community, because there is a girl who is in my humanities class. And she said that her grandmother on her mother's side is Native American. I forgot what tribe specifically, but she's Native American, and she has that percentage of blood to be determined as, well, you're a part of this tribe. And also, her grandmom is Native American, so it's like, okay, well, yeah, you're in. And she says she's went to a few gatherings, and it's fun. She enjoys herself there. She feels like she's at home. And it's like, well, what about those people? Are you going to deport those people? I mean, yeah, sure. Like, they're black and they're white, but they're just as much of a Native American as, you know, a full-blown Native American is. Would you deport these people, or would you keep them on, you know, the land if, you know, I guess deportation were to happen? And then also another problem I just thought about, because this is the same thing with white ethnostaters when they're like, well, how would you guys make a white ethnostate? Oh, I don't know. Let's just deport all the black and brown people out the country. Well, one, there are people who've lived here for most of their lives. Well, even all their, some cases most, some cases all. And it's like, they don't want to leave. I'm sorry. If you think that you can easily get people to leave, even under forcible conditions, there are some people who say, no, this is my property. I grew up here. This is my country. I grew up here. I'm not going to leave. How would you deal with that? And then the number one answer is, well, I guess you could say we just kill them off. I wouldn't call it genocide, but we kill them off. No, well, that is genocide. I'm sorry genocide. To tell you.
And that's the issue you run into anybody who says that we should make a bunch of policies, especially the relocation policies, based on race. Yeah, that's one of the issues is, yeah, what do you do with all those people who have lived here all their lives? And how is that just for them? How is that just for the people who have been here all their lives and who call this home? And the one I was really interested in talking about with her is like, well, how do you determine what race someone is? Like, is there a genetic component of race that you're talking about? So Ray believes that there is a genetic component to race that is intrinsic within a person and that cannot be ignored, and that affects like your, that affects like how close you are to land. It affects how you interact with the environment. Like, it's your genes.
It's somewhat like the magic soil theory almost, right?
Yeah, or the magic dirt theory, yeah.
Yeah, magic dirt, yeah.
Yeah, so you come over here and you just bring all of your dirt with you because, yeah, once you get over here, you're more of who you were in your ancestry than you are when you are here. That's something that, if that sounds familiar to you, that's because that's what white nationalists believe. That where you come from is way more important to who you are than like how you grew up and who you are now. So one of the things, the thing that like started this entire debate off, the one because I agreed to it like 2 hours beforehand. I had 2 hours of preparation time. Is that she went on JF Jarapi's Scream. I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but do you know who JF Jarapi is?
Garoppi.
Garoppi.
It's pronounced weird, but yeah, people just call him JF.
JF, yeah. JF is a white nationalist from Quebec. And she was so excited that she got him to, in her words, acquiesce to a point that she was making, which is that Native Americans should have their own land separate from white people. And she was so proud that she got a white nationalist to admit, in quotes, that white people and Native American people should live on different lands. She was so proud of that. Because...
And it's like, he already believes this, Ray. Ray, he already believes this. If you just watch maybe 5 minutes of a video where he's talking about race, and he says... And like he kind of mentioned something about genetics and land or immigration, and like, oh yeah, well, I just don't think that these people should live together because they fundamentally can't. I'm sorry, they can't do that. It's just like, oh, bro, he believes in this. You didn't get him to admit anything. He already believes in this because he's a white nationalist, right?
Yeah, if when that happens, when a white nationalist shares your views on race almost to like a T, shouldn't that cause you just a little bit of pause?
Right. Shouldn't you like question? Because like, if you're a leftist and you're talking to a white nationalist and you guys agree on this point that races, that different races can't fundamentally be together or live together, shouldn't like can't you just like take a pause for like 1 second when you're talking to that person, say, man, what, where did I go wrong?
Where did I go wrong? Why do I think this way about race? So something that we talked about, because I wanted to really ask her, like, scientifically, do you think that race exists as a taxonomic reality? Which is to say, do you think that it's a legitimate way to classify different humans into, I don't know, different subspecies or whatever race realists believe? And she kept waffling. She wouldn't give me a definitive answer. But she kept saying something along the lines that race is a social construct based on a phylogenetic reality or something similar to that. And I wanted to talk to her about the science behind race, because there is a little bit, there is science behind race. And the big thing is something called the fixation index, or FST values. So if you don't know what FST values are, fixation index is, imagine, I'm going to explain it in a very simplistic way here. So imagine that you had a group of red strawberries and a group of blue strawberries. Big old differences. One's all red, one's all blue. There's nothing in common between them. And now imagine that you had two groups, and one was mostly red and one was mostly blue, but there was some intermixing in there. Well, then their FST value would be a little bit more similar. Or the FST value would show that they're a little bit more similar. And now imagine that you had one group that was half red, half blue, and another group that was half red, half blue. Well, they're essentially the same. So their FST value would show that they are basically the same. And
right.
Yeah, and you've read a study that showed something similar between races, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that study.
So there was a case with two European scientists and one Asian scientist, and basically the two European scientists, they pretty much thought that the, I guess the variation between them would be similar rather than the Asian scientist, because, well, we both grew up in Europe, he grew up in Asia, he looks different than us, you know, blah, blah, blah. So when they did the study, they were shocked to found that, I mean, to find, sorry, not found, find that both of them, they actually had a lot in common with the Asian scientists than they did between each other.
Yeah, and that's what we find in a lot of quote-unquote race science, I don't know a better word for it, is that most of the what we consider races, there's more genetic diversity within a race than there is between races. Which is to say, for example, like in Africa, so, you know, there's more genetic variation within Africa than there is anywhere else on the planet. So it's actually very likely that someone in Africa is going to have more in common with a white person in Wisconsin than they're going to have in common with another person in Africa who just happens to live on the same continent as them, even though they look more similar to the latter than the former. That's what we,
right.
That's kind of what we know about like FST values and, again, quote unquote race science. But a lot of race realists will say, well, they look different, so they are. And they'll leave it at that. Or they'll, or they'll say something like, oh, we know where you're coming, like we can predict like where your ancestors come from. And they'll say that, and they'll use that as a proxy for race. Like, well, yeah, man, where do you think you come from? Like, it depends on how far back you want to go, right? Like, where you come from. There were people before that, too. That's how they got there. Like, so where do you stop? Where do you actually come from? Like, it's kind of arbitrary where you stop, right? And she couldn't answer that, because to do so would have to admit that she thinks, you know, race realism is a thing, which she kind of does, because a lot of her arguments stemmed from, well, if you grew up in a, if your ancestors grew up in this environment, you're going to have more claim to it, or you're going to take better care of it, because genetically, you're more in tune with that environment.
Thank you.
And if you are not from an environment, if your ancestors came from somewhere else, well, genetically, you're just incompatible with that environment, and you're going to destroy it. What does that sound like?
A race real?
Yeah, it sounds like a white nationalist who believes in like the hordes of, you know, immigrants coming over here who just aren't going to take care of the place because it's not where they're really from.
So I just got dinner. I got carrots and spaghetti, guys. That's great.
Yay! Wait, what? Say that again?
Carrots and spaghetti.
You got carrots and spaghetti on the podcast now.
You know what? I love carrots. They're my favorite vegetable. Yeah. And I also love spaghetti, too. So I'm not mad.
You're not mad. That's a pretty good combination to have, I think. I think that's... All right. And also, you know what that does? It serves as a pretty good transition.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it does. Carrots and spaghetti mixing together in harmony. It's a pretty good way to end that. So let's talk about the second thing we wanted to talk about.
So the second thing we were going to talk about is your other debate with, you guys might not know this person, Count Dankula, you know, Scottish YouTuber, made a video where, you know, he turned his dog into a Nazi, you know, not a big deal. No. So tell the audience about that one.
So what we wanted to talk about was humor, specifically, like, can humor influence somebody? Can comedy influence somebody to change their behaviors? The, you know, explosive, like, thumbnail version of that is, does comedy turn people into Nazis? That's the explosive version of that. But what I wanted to talk about was a little bit more nuanced and, like, can humor influence our behaviors? And that stream lasted for 4 hours. Now, I know some people have seen internet streams go on for way longer than that, but that's the longest one I've ever done, and it was like mentally and spiritually draining to talk for that long, even if it's something I genuinely deeply care about, which is comedy. I love comedy. And some brave individuals actually stuck around for all of it.
And I was one of them.
You were one of them. So I know how it was like actually participating and talking. What was it like for you to sit and listen to 4 hours of me and Count Dankula talking about comedy? What did you think of it?
It was frustrating. It was audibly frustrating. Not because of you, but just because of Dank. oh my God. So he mentions his part in Blazing Saddles, where if you guys know about Blazing Saddles, I mean, if you don't, then you've been living under a rock.
Great movie.
Don't know about Blazing Saddles. It's a movie from the 70s. It's a comedy movie that revolves around old westerns. You know, that's kind of the play on it. It's like an old western, but it's comedic. It's funny. But in the movie, the black sheriff, he's the new sheriff in town, and he's black. In the old West, I guess you guys can imagine where I'm going with this. So he sees an elderly, sweet looking white lady. You know, she's just like stereotypical grandma. And he's like, howdy, fine morning we're having, right? And she's like, up yours, N-word, with a strong E-R at the end. And when SJW Nabase and Dankula were talking about this, Dankula was like, yeah, that was like the best part of the movie. And yeah, it's actually one of the most notable parts of that film. But the reason why he finds it funny is just shocking. You know, I wouldn't expect an old, nice looking lady to say, oh, you know, that I sound like a Russian. I'm going to stop doing the accent. he's like, it's just shocking that an old lady will like just say, oh, yeah, up yours, N-word. I wouldn't expect that from an old, nice lady. And it's like, you know, I find it funny. A lot of things that you find funny are shocking, you know. As a matter of fact, you wanted your whole Nazi pug thing to be shocking.
Yeah, but that's where we have to stop, because that's all there is to comedy, actually, according to Count Dankula, is that comedy is shocking. The reason people love shocking humor so much is because we just don't see it anymore. Everybody's so coddled and holed up in their safe spaces that they're just desperate for anything that's shocking. So they go out and they hear something that is completely off the wall, and then they can't deal with it, and they just laugh because they don't know how else to deal with it. Okay, I was focused on the accent there.
He did a better accent than me. I guess we can all agree that SJW Debates does a better Scottish accent than I ever could.
That's really the most important thing to take away from all of this, is that after listening to Count Dankula for 3 hours or 4 hours, I have a marginally better Scottish accent than I used to. But what he would argue from the get, from start to finish for 3 hours, we almost talked in circles, was that all comedy is being shocking. And that since mm-hmm. that's all it is, you can't read too much into it. Not only can you not, you shouldn't read too much into comedy. You shouldn't assume any intentions that a comedian has, because that's missing the entire point. But.
Right.
But. After 3 hours of talking to Count Dankula and me trying to explain the theories of comedy and why comedy can be a very effective tool for influencing people and changing minds and espousing information and rhetoric, he comes back in after we've hung up because he wants to argue with someone that I brought on stream. And do you remember his entire point of his Nazi Pug video? Do you remember what he said about it? He said that his Nazi Pug video was lampooning Nazis. The entire point of his video was to lampoon Nazis, and that's why you shouldn't call him a Nazi.
I'm sorry, that question caught me off guard because I was just enjoying these carrots, but but yeah, his whole point was that he actually said this in a tweet too about the new upcoming movie Jojo Rabbit. If you guys don't know what that is, I'm just going to give a quick synopsis from the trailer. So basically, there's this young German boy during World War II. He is a youth Nazi. That's what I'm just going to call him. I don't know the technical term, but he's just a young boy who's a Nazi in training. And he has an imaginary friend version of Hitler. And later on, it seems like what's going to happen in the movie based off the trailer is later on, he discovers that a young Jewish girl is living in his house. She's, well, not living, but hiding.
Yeah.
So it seems like what's going to happen is she's going to try to make him see that, like, well, or make him question, why are you doing this? You know, have you ever considered, like, we're not that bad? Like, we're probably not bad people. Maybe you're just being targeted unfairly, which would be a good message for the film about this. I mean, of course, you know, most people would, I guess, like most people except for, well, neo-Nazis, they'd probably, you know, most people would see that, yeah, well, they obviously weren't the bad people in that situation. They were obviously targeted. But I guess they want to, I guess what the film probably is going to do is like take that point and show it in a different light. I want to go see it. Yeah. I want to go see it.
It
I haven't been to
awesome.
A movie theater in 12 years. The last movie
Whoa!
I saw. The last movie I saw was B Movie.
Oh man, that's
a
good one to end
old.
On. Though.
I think that was like after my birthday or on my birthday. We went to go see B Movie, me and my mom, and I was 8. I remember this. I laughed my ass off at B Movie. I thought it was the funniest movie ever. But now that I look back on it, I'm like,
I don't know.
It's not that funny.
That's almost that's almost like a good life story. Like the last movie I ever saw in theaters was B Movie, and that's all. That's it.
I was supposed to go see Avengers Endgame, but I just didn't have the money at the time. I wanted to go see it.
That's a good one to end on.
I'm like, I want to go to the theaters and see this, but it just didn't happen. But
yeah. There's something interesting about that movie that you were just describing, though, the one with the Nazi youth and the little Jewish girl. It's a comedy, right?
Yeah.
It's a comedy that's conveying a very, like, sincere message that we're supposed to take to heart. But for 3 hours, it was like arguing against this wall of stubborn stupidity.
Mm-hmm.
He said that if it comes from a comedian or if it comes from a comedic piece of entertainment, we can't take anything from it. Because since it's mm-hmm. a comedy, it's not being serious.
I remember he made like the whole like joke. If you guys know about this one, it's a pretty famous joke. It's like when you're in English class and you're reading a book and a sentence says the curtain is blue and the teacher says, well, yeah, the curtain's blue because the character is going through a crippling depression and they also have anxiety. And blue is often the color that's associated with those two qualities, depression and anxiety or sadness in general. And the author's like, no, I just said the curtain was fucking blue because I'm trying to describe the fucking curtain. I don't care about the character's feelings at this point. He made that joke and it made me cringe. It's like, well, okay. One, you have to question certain, like when it comes to certain mediums, like with art or, well, in general with art, comedy is an art. I would qualify as an art.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But, in general with art, you have to question the artist's intent. So like, let me just give the example of like, I'm in an art appreciation class and it's actually made me appreciate art more, even though I've been in it for like 3 weeks.
Nice.
But we were, I remember recently we saw Jean-Michel Basquiat's paintings. The art teacher always does this. She has like little slideshows, like their paintings and music over it. And we talked afterwards, we discussed like what's the meaning behind these paintings? Like what's like probably the subject material. And the conclusion we all came to was, okay, well, one, Jean-Michel Basquiat was a Haitian Puerto Rican from Haitian and Puerto Rican descent. He grew up in New York. He grew up in a predominantly black community. And most of the subjects of his paintings are black men, young black men. And we kind of thought, okay, well, that's the subject matter. But he does it in a way that's like street art. And he did, and he was homeless for some time. So maybe, I mean, I could imagine he was painting before this, but what if he saw other forms of graffiti art and it kind of inspired him to like just do his own style of it? We have to question his intent. We have to question, well, what's the meaning behind it? So when it comes to comedy, say if you have a comedian that keeps making jokes about LGBTQ plus people, that's just their main material. Like, sure, they'll make jokes here and there about like other things like race and sex and all this other stuff, but they mostly focus on LGBTQ plus people, and they do it in a way that's a bit negative. Wouldn't you sit there and say, oh, wow, most of their jokes are talking about a certain group of people. Like, do they hate them or something?
Yeah.
Count Dankula, Count Dankula, on the other hand, is like, oh, it's just a joke, man. It's just a joke. Like, they don't hate them. It's just a joke. Stop being PC, bro.
Count Dankula would say that dude, he's just making pictures. He's just putting a bunch of colors on the sheet. Just appreciate the pretty pictures. Don't look deeper into
right.
it.
Right. And wait. And, if you guys want to see a Jean-Michel Basquiat painting, I don't know, like maybe around this point, just like pull one up because it's interesting. I like it.
So those of you watching on YouTube should see it right now. And those of you listening on the podcast, check out our YouTube.
I can guarantee you Count Dankula will look at this and will probably be like, this isn't art. What is this? They put this up in the gallery. As a matter of fact, that one of his paintings actually sold for $110.87 million. It was bought by a Japanese billionaire, I think, in 2017, I think. $110.87 million. So the person who bought this painting thought it was interesting. But Count Dankula would probably look at this, and I can imagine he'd look at this and say, what the hell is this? Like, what is this? That's art, Count Dankula. Art is something that's subjective. It's not something that's objective. Like, this is the whole point of that one art piece that was like a urinal, and people were like, this isn't art. Some people, well, this is art, you know, like what? And then you have people questioning, well, what is art? You know, something that is not art to you may be something that's art to someone else.
Yeah, there's so much subjectivity in art
that other people appreciate.
There's so much subjectivity and there's so much appreciation to be had for all different forms of art. And then to say that comedy, that doesn't apply to comedy. Comedy is just this thing that we do that doesn't really matter. And, you know, we can't look into it and there's no meaning behind it. That lowers comedy to a form that is to something that is less than art, to something that is less than worth valuing. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is like so disrespectful to all the great comedians who came before. Like a lot of these guys who say that we look too seriously in a joke and nobody can take a joke anymore, will like hold up as like heroes people like Richard Pryor and George Carlin.
Yeah,
George Carlin. And man, they were extremely influential and they were great, not because that they were controversial or they were not PC, but because like they believed in their like a message that they were putting forth, and that message stuck with people. That message like resonated within people and made them laugh so much harder because they were like tugging on these heartstrings that made them like really feel and really think, and that's why they were great. The reason,
right?
Yeah, comedy is so important because it touches something like deep within us that like lets us know that things are okay and like relieves all this tension. And the deeper you can reach, the more tension you can release, and that's what makes a great comic.
And the funny thing is like, even if you look at George Carlin's work, like I watched one where he was like, people don't really have rights. I think it was like Americans don't really have rights. And, you know, he of course he makes jokes here and there, but he's able to also say things like, oh, well.
Yeah, I'll get it.
He also makes joke. Well, not well, he makes jokes here and there, but he also says things like, oh, when you talk, when you look at the Japanese, right, an American living during World War II, what happened to them? They thought they had rights. Look at what happened to them. They got put in internment camps and they had their rights taken away just like that. So do we really have rights? And it makes you think, you know, with Count Dankula, he sees comedy and he's like, oh, I'm just supposed to have a laugh. You know, it's just a picture. It's supposed to make me laugh. I don't see any meaning behind it. But I also find it funny how he holds up George Carlin as a hero, yet he doesn't note how George Carlin, he not only made you laugh, but he made you think. He made you rethink your perspective of the world. And I noticed, like, with a lot of these right-wing people, and yeah, you could say there's even some people on the left or just liberals in general who do this, but it's more so with right-wingers, how they look at George Carlin and all they can think about is, oh yeah, if he lived today, he would be ashamed of comedy because it's so PC. Look at him. He was so anti-PC. You know, he just said what came to his mind. Nobody cared. And it's like, but... So, yeah. He did it with care.
Who were the people who were mad at George Carlin when he was active? Do you think it was like, it wasn't like the extreme, like sensitive, like left wing people? It was a lot of like conservative right wingers who were upset that he was like mocking God and pushing secularism and saying all the naughty words. Like, that's why he was quote unquote controversial. And he didn't say these things to upset people. He said these things because he believed in things like free speech, and he believed in being able to say what was on your mind without fear of like backlash.
And I'm pretty sure that a lot of right wingers wouldn't appreciate his specials on abortion.
Yeah.
Well, not specials, but I guess you could say
his routines. Yeah.
Yeah, his routines about abortion, where he says, you know what, people who are against abortion, fuck you. You guys aren't anti-abortion, you're anti-woman. Or his skits on, not, oh my God, why do I keep saying skits? His routines on religion, where he criticizes religion and says, oh yeah, like, is there really a God? Yeah, there is a God. Well, I forgot how it went, but he just criticized the idea of people believing in something that they can't really see. Or don't know exist exactly. Yeah. And he even did the same thing in the rights routine. He was like, oh, well, where do rights come from? Rights come from God. Oh, well, here we go a fucking again. Like, I'm pretty sure they wouldn't appreciate these things. But just the fact that it seems like he sounds like he's being offensive and it sounds like he's outspoken, they appreciate that aspect, but they can't appreciate the aspect of him, you know, giving out messages with care and making sure that his views come out onto the stage and that it's interpreted by the audience in their own way, in their own perspective, you know?
Yeah, he seems to think that anybody who steps on stage like just loses all of what makes them themselves, and they're just there to say things that are shocking, which, you know, is why every comic is the same and no comic has, you know, a distinct personality or anything like that, which is amazing because he even said that the people who, so did you watch Dave Chappelle's newest special?
I heard about it.
You heard about it. It was okay. It actually wasn't as offensive.
Yeah, I'll actually try to see if I can watch it, because I have an app on my phone where I can like look at TV shows and movies, but yeah. I'll see if it's on there.
Yeah. Cause it was all right. It wasn't as offensive as a lot of people say it is, but also wasn't as funny as a lot of people seem to think it is.
But I did see a clip from it where I think he talks about like he was in a room with I think it was like some type of executive producer, maybe just let's just say an executive.
Yeah.
And she says, oh, well, you know, like, I guess it's like you can say the N word, but you can't say the word, excuse my language here. I don't know if I can say it, but I'm just going to say, excuse my language.
Yeah.
Faggot. The word faggot. And he's like, well, hold up. How can I say the N word, but I can't say faggot? And he said it just like that.
Yeah, he's screaming like, on stage.
I'm like,
yeah. And the joke he made, he's like, well, Dave, you're not gay. And then he replied with, well, I'm not an N word either. That joke was like pushing. That actually was one of the best jokes in the entire special.
Mm-hmm.
Because like that joke was like pushing an ant. It was like playing with your preconceived notion of like what is the connection to these words that people have. It was playing on those notions, and it was like, it was a really good joke. It was like one of the few good jokes that were actually good. But most people, when they talk about Dave Chappelle special, they talk about the anti-trans joke. And yeah, it was an anti-trans joke. It was a transphobic joke. It was an attack helicopter joke, just like we've heard a billion of.
Oh, it was an attack.
It wasn't. He didn't say attack helicopter, but it was like, you know, I identify as a Chinese man, and it was bad.
And it's like, Doug, always that one joke. It's just always the one joke.
Yeah, if there's only the biggest criticism I have of that special is that he seems tired. He seems like he's just not having fun anymore. And that's just not what, it's not a great look. It can be a great look. It just wasn't for him. So maybe there's some common ground that we can have with Dankula. Like, yeah, you gotta, your comedian has to look like they're enjoying themselves a little bit up there.
Yeah.
But he made the comment that right-wing people seem to love the special and left-wing people didn't seem to love the special. And he made it just, I don't know why he made that, because it was making my point that, yeah, like, who you are as a person dictates what you find funny. And if that happens on the audience end, don't you think it happens on the comedian's end too? Don't you think you're going to make jokes that you think are funny? Because after all, you can't assume your audience. You can't control your audience. So why not make jokes that you find funny? And so the kinds of things that you find funny, if we know that what you find funny says something about you, as evidenced by those different audiences who liked Dave Chappelle's special, can't we find like what the comedian finds funny to say something about them? And it was just a wall of stupidity that I was throwing that at against for 3 hours. And it just came back to, yeah, you can't take comedians seriously. It's just comedy. And it lowered it as an art form, which that was, to come back to that again, that's what I thought was the most egregious. I love comedy so much. It's my favorite art form. And to lower it to something that's not worth consideration, I think is enormously insulting to the great comedians, to the people who are busting their butts, putting in the time and effort to be funny, who are like making it, who are putting in all this effort to something that apparently you shouldn't take seriously.
Yeah. So is there anything else you want to talk about?
That was, after that debate, I was wiped for 3 days. Like, talking that long in circles for that long was just like so draining. And then afterwards on Wednesday, so the day after the debate, I got into another argument with Ray on Twitter, which just sapped all. Yeah, so it came full circle. I debate Ray on Tuesday of 1 week. I debate Dank on Tuesday of the next week. And then Wednesday of that week, Ray comes back into my mentions on Twitter and like messages me on Discord and just says all of this horrible stuff about how, oh man, I'm not going to get into too much Twitter drama there, but it all came full circle. And it's been a great week. It's been stressful, but it's been fun. Yeah, I got hosted by the Serfs. That was really, really cool.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, the Serfs are awesome, by the way, if you don't know.
Yeah, they are. They pop into a few of my streams. I like them being there. They don't stay long, though, which kind of makes me sad, because I'm like, please, just stay a little longer. You guys make the stream so much more interesting. But
they hosted that. They've retweeted my video on comedy, which...
Oh, yeah, I saw that. That was nice.
That was so cool. I liked that so much. Because they're people who I really respect, and they do a really good job of raising the profile of a lot of smaller bread tubers, which we've done that in the past before, but they just have more reach than we do for now. We're coming. Yeah. We're coming for you, Serfs. We're on your heels. So that was really cool, and I'm feeling good about where I'm feeling good about where my content's going, and a lot of even with a lot of the Twitter drama, I think that it's something that we can overcome and we're going to get through it. Because I know, and I've met enough cool people like you, like a lot of you guys, like Bailey, like Loser One, like One Species, and a bunch of other people, like Amanda, Miranda. And I feel really good about like the community that we're building. And I'm really excited the direction we're going. And I think that we're gonna do good. So I've been... That's my little sob story. I feel after that and the support that I received, especially from a lot of people that I really respect, like you, like all those people I mentioned, I'm feeling good afterwards. So,
yeah. So, because I know we kind of talked about this a little bit before the podcast, but like some of our, like, I guess like our experience with debating.
Yeah. So what do you think about debating?
Especially online since debates. 99.9% of all debates I get into are on Twitter, because that's the place where I'm most active. Like, I don't think I posted a video on my channel in about 2 weeks, but that's going to change tonight because I already got one.
Yes!
It's not an extensive video, but you'll see what happens. But I have to say, when it comes to debating, it's like I always kind of struggle with this, but I am going to work on it. It's trying to keep your cool when you debate, because the moment you get upset or the moment you get flustered is the moment where everything you want to say or everything that you know, it becomes something that's foreign to you. Yeah. You kind of lose perspective. Like, I like watching White Nervosa debate. She's actually a streamer that I came across, I think, about a month ago, and she's really good. Because what she does is she relatively stays calm in her debates. I have not seen one debate of hers where she gets angry, or, you know, where she pulls, like, let's say a Destiny or a Vosh, where she gets angry at the person she's debating, or where she kind of says, well, that's dumb because X, Y, Z. Instead, she's calm. She's like a teacher. I saw someone comment on her video. They're like, you're such a patient teacher. And I'm like, that's so true. You know, it's almost like she is teaching them rather than like talking to them, or rather than telling them why it's wrong. She's almost teaching them why it's wrong. Now, of course, at the end of the debate, sometimes they may not get it still. And that's okay, because I think that debates, this might be a basic bitch reason, my reason for debates. This might be a bit basic bitch, but I feel like debates, rather than being contests to see who's like, who has the better idea, right? Like, oh yeah, well, I think this person has a better idea. Well, I think this person does. I feel like, well, I guess you could say political debates are sort of like that, like whose idea is the best for the country or whatever. But
which is very different than online debates, though, right?
Yeah, but yeah, that's real different. But in terms of like online debating, I feel like it should be just an exchange of ideas. I feel like, because the moment you make it like a contest, that's the moment where shit goes haywire. That's the moment where you get pissed off, then the other person gets pissed off, and then you guys get nowhere. It's almost like you guys are going in circles. So I feel like if you try to stay calm and look at it as like, not a conversation, but I guess like a discussion.
Yeah.
Like, well, okay, well, why do you think what I'm saying is not right? You know, I feel like at that point, that's where the debate goes smooth.
And there's something to be said that, yeah, it's really cool when you watch like highlights and clips from a debate where someone just getting wrecked and just they're getting really excited and like your person won and it feels great, but you were already on their side. They didn't win you over. You just felt good. So when you're debating someone, I think something that we should strive to do is actually win some of their fans over, to say that, hey, look, I'm thoughtful. I'm not mad. I'm not screeching at people. I'm not here to yell at the person that you like. I do want to talk about things, and staying calm and staying reasonable is effective. It's not going to get any, it's not going to get all of them or even most of them, but it's going to get a few if you do a good job. Like, there's have you heard of the 40-40-20 rule?
30-40-20.
It's not a real rule, but it's especially in online debate.
I probably heard of it. I just can't recognize it now.
Yeah, it's assuming that everyone has the same size audience, which was not the case with me and Dankula. I'm actually surprised I didn't like throw up from being nervous on that. 40% who are your fans to begin with, we're going to side with you no matter what. The 40% who are like fans of theirs, we're going to side with them no matter what. But there's that 20%, that little group in the middle who's just kind of interested. And maybe they were sort of your fan or sort of the other person's fan. That's the group you're trying to win over. And
I think I heard of this. I think I might have heard of it, but I just can't remember.
Yeah. And do you think that I ever got like mad at Dankula, or I ever like attacked him a ton?
I mean, there were parts where like you kind of did get a little frustrated because it was like, oh yeah, well, you're not really seeing where I'm coming from. And I don't understand that, because there were parts where even Dankula said this, like, oh, I think we just look at comedy differently. You know, I look at it to just laugh, and you look at it to like think about it, and you know, that's just weird.
And there was something cool about that, because there's some people in his audience who thought, well, I actually am a little bit interested in knowing how comedy works. I'm a little bit interested in learning a little bit more about how, you know, why something is funny and how that affects us. Maybe since this dude was so nice, I'm gonna go check him out. And I got 100 subs,
and I learned that so much in my second debate, because with Flamenco I got mad and then I left. Now what he did to me was scummy, But I made an excuse to leave. And I was like, well, my dinner's ready. One, dinner was still cooking, but I was going to eat.
Yeah.
It just, and I made the excuse that my dinner was ready. And he's like, well, you know, don't go back to your hug box, basically, like my chat, and like talk about how bad he was, which I did. I was frustrated. I was upset because he was kind of making me a little upset. And I was telling myself, maybe you should just end the stream right here. But I was like, no, I want to keep going. You know, I just want to do the stream by myself. But what he did was he broadcasted my stream on his stream.
Yeah.
So pretty much his viewers were watching what I was doing and he was watching what I was doing. And I thought that was just scummy. I thought it was scummy. But after the stream, what I did was I deleted my version of that debate, of that stream. I deleted it because I realized, man, I just lost his audience. So a moment where I could have basically maybe, I guess, changed some minds, or at least sort of make them question, well, is race really real? Is there like some sort of real aspect to it? And then I saw what was happening with Leftist Lemon, where one, he actually got invited to his Discord. And there were people in his audience who saw him as like the calm and rational one and me as the one that got mad and left and, you know, was a crybaby. So I looked at that and I was like, man, you know, that I really kind of I blew it a little bit. That's why I was kind of saying to myself, like, I really blew it. If maybe I approached it a bit more calmly, and maybe when he was like saying like little things that kind of ticked me off, like, oh, well, really, you're going to point that out to me? Like when he said race realism is a medieval practice, and I'm like, it's not really medieval. I'm like, it first started around the 1700s during the Age of Reason, and it lasted mainly until the 1950s. It's not really medieval. And he was like, oh, you're going to tell me I'm wrong about that. And I'm like, and that's what made me mad. If I just approached it more like, well, yeah, I mean, you were kind of wrong on it. And I was just, you know, trying to state that, you know, really isn't that medieval. Maybe if I did that, maybe his audience would have saw me in the same light that they saw Leftist Lemon. Maybe I wouldn't be viewed as the one that got mad and the one that left, or the one that was like going to their hug box, which is why my Discord is named Oreo's hug box.
Yeah. Nice.
I kind of took it as a joke at the time, and I was still mad. But it was just funny to me, and I was like, bro, I'm just going to name my Discord Oreo's Hug Box.
Nice.
But, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's debate is risky, and it is extremely tough, and it's hard not to get really mad at a lot of people who are coming at you in bad faith, you know, just calling you stupid and everything like that. But there's some benefit of it because, you know, you learn from that. You did better in your second one. I've learned a lot from people who have performed like not the best in the past, and it's something that I think that we should continue to do more of, because we don't need to convince people on the left. They're on our side. Maybe there's some like discussions to be had, especially if there are some ideas on the left like Ray's that go just completely outside of the realm of like morality, but the people that we need to talk to are on the right, and refusing to talk to them and not treating them like they're reachable is an enormous disservice to our own cause. And so this isn't even an act, like be open, like be charitable, be more charitable than you get. And there's going to be some people in that audience who are going to hear you being charitable, being reasonable, being calm, being funny.
Right.
Being funny is a big part of it too.
Because when you think about it, it's almost like the whole idea of like, because I remember this with high school. It was like with freshmen. And when I was, I think, a sophomore, there were already sophomores who were like teasing the freshmen. But I went to a school where it was like integrated a little bit. It was like 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. So they were messing with the 7th graders. And I'm like, well, we were them once. That's how we're here. That's how we got here. We were in 7th grade once. We got picked on by the freshmen and the sophomore and the juniors and the seniors. We got called weird and annoying. And it's like, well, why are you doing it to them? And it's, and you know, when it comes to debating, it's like, cause I, at one point was a right wing chud, So it's like the way I'm, because I'm starting to change my view on it now. It's like the way I see it is like, well, I was you once, right? It's almost like when old people, when you're talking to an old person and like, and you know, they view as a little bit misguided and they're like, well, I was your age once and I did what you did, but I'm just going to tell you right now, if you keep doing what you're doing the way you're doing it, then it's not going to work out. I'm sorry. And I think those are the people that when you listen to them, they make you draw in more rather than if they were being brash, rather than if they said, well, I was your age once and I was like you and I don't like you because of that. You're just really like just disgusting.
Yeah,
that would make you like, I remember Pigpuncher. He was talking about when he was going down the rabbit hole and how his mom, he fell asleep one night. This is funny. He fell asleep one night and he had a Chris Ray gun video left open on his phone. And she walked into his room to wake him up one day and she saw it and she talked to him about it. And he was like she talked to me about it and she was like, well, this is wrong. Like, just don't watch it anymore. Like, what he's saying isn't true. And he's like, man, I start to think my mom was like one of those evil feminists. You know, like I didn't see what she was talking about. And I'm like, yeah.
Seeing a little bit of yourself there, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Like even with like when I first started taking sociology, like my sociology teacher, she's a liberal. I'm just going to say liberal because I don't know like where she actually stands. But I know that she's left leaning. And when I first went into her class and she mainly talked about like feminist theory and how that plays a role in society or like women's role in society in the modern world. And then she was talking about that. When I first saw her, I was like, dog, it is true, man. Everything that these people are saying, like, oh, yeah, the left, they all they want to do is like talk about why men are bad, you know. And I kind of saw her at first like that, like, oh, yeah, she thinks men are bad. Yeah. Yeah. She's one of them. She's one of those people that they talk about. But the more I listened and the more that she got engaged with not just me, but the whole class. And the more like I saw her point, it was like, man, maybe she is right. Like, maybe I want to like dig deeper into this. Maybe I want to see, like, is it true that, you know, in female prisons, women going through sterilization practice, is that true? I didn't even know about that. No one mentioned that to me. Or the glass ceiling theory, like, man, is there a glass ceiling that still hasn't been broken? I mean, sure, some women have broken through it. I mean, the CEO of Xerox is a woman, a black woman at that. But is there still a bit of that glass ceiling that some women can't punch through or get through? Yeah. And, you know, that was my journey down the left. It all started in sociology, a class that I didn't like. I think I chose that class. I don't think I had to take it, but I chose it because I was interested. But yeah, she really changed my perspective on a lot. I'll never forget her. Professor Mans. No, Dr. Mans. Dr. Mans. Yeah. I'll never forget her. She always changed. She always you remember for changing my perspective. But
it's always
that she did it in a way that was calm and professional and patient. She didn't get mad. Like, there was this one kid in my class named Malik, and I don't know if he's changed his perspective on things, but he had the same view that I had going into that class. When she said, when she was talking about the wage gap, and he brought up, oh, well, you see, it's because of women choose like jobs that don't pay well, or they go into professions that don't pay well. You know, that's the reason why the wage gap exists. And at first I agreed with him. I was like, yes. Yeah. In my mind, I was agreeing with him. Everybody else around me was laughing at him. They were literally laughing at him, saying stuff under their breath. In my mind, I'm like, man, those YouTube right wingers are right. Like, look at all these people just reacting to something he's saying. And then when she said, I'll never forget what she said. She was like, well, Malik, why do they go into those professions? Like, do you think that a male would become a nurse easily as a woman would? Like, if a man had to choose between becoming the doctor or the nurse, do you think that a man would choose to become the nurse rather than the doctor? And if so, why? And he was unable to answer that. And I was also unable to answer that. Nobody in the class could answer that, as a matter of fact. And it just blew me away. It blew me away. And she was like, well, why do women go into like education more than men do? Why are there more female teachers than men or female nurses? And then she started talking about like just gender stereotyping. You know, the idea that women make better caregivers than men because of X, Y, Z. Or the idea that women are better in education professions or nursing professions or just medical professions, like with nursing or home care providers. Why do you think that is? And it's like, man, that's interesting. So she didn't say, well, Malik, that's dumb because X, Y, Z. That would have affirmed my belief about, I guess you could say, people who kind of believe in feminist theory,
yeah,
a bit more, that, yeah, yeah, they're right. They are like this. They are mean. But the way how she did it, the way how she calmly told Malik, or, well, not told, but asked, yeah, him, like, well, why do you think there are more female nurses than male nurses? Do you think that men would easily agree to becoming a nurse if that was a choice? Well, I mean, it is a choice, but like, let's say, like, hypothetically, if they were presented in only the medical field with becoming the doctor or the nurse, do you think that men would go with the nurse easily? As like, as I guess you could say, a lot of women do. And I was like, man, that, wow, I never thought about it that way. So yeah, she's a really interesting person. I actually want to have a conversation with her. I've been meaning to do it, but maybe I might do it Monday if she's in her office.
There you
go. I still remember where it is.
Get her on the podcast.
Oh yeah, oh my god, if she would come on the podcast and just
talk to us, that'd be really cool, right?
That would be great.
That would actually be really, really cool. Yeah,
like, because she's really cool. She actually did a study in Michigan on I think it was women's treatment in prisons. Because her husband at the time, he worked in the he worked as a corrections officer in a female prison. And so I was like, oh yeah, that's really convenient. So she said that he couldn't really do it because he might lose his job, but he did it anyway. And he got her the data, and the rest was history. So, and I think she said that her main outlook are women's treatment and in particular, African American women's treatment in prisons and in the medical and in the healthcare system. Because she also noted, like, oh yeah, like I think she's an advocate for socialized healthcare or socialized universal healthcare. Because she was like, when you look at the current healthcare system, like, when you look at like the life expectancy numbers for white people versus other races, and you see where black people are, she's like, you have to kind of think, well, why is it that way? And she's like, if you look at socioeconomics, like where black people are economically, like, sure, even the richest black people can die at the same rate as the poorest one. Like, they might. And she's like, well, why is that? You know, so yeah, I really want, if she could come on the podcast, man, that would be
really, really cool.
Oh my god, that'd be dope. I would like her on the podcast.
Well, hey, you know what? We have a lot of cool stuff planned. I would absolutely, no joke, have that being in the works in the future if we can get her.
Yeah,
if we can get her, yeah.
I'll have to add. Like, I really,
go
I,
and
I
ask. Really, I'm, go
I,
and
I
ask.
I gotta ask her now, because man.
All right, so we talked about two debates. We talked about debate in general, and we talked even a little bit of sociology.
Yeah.
It was a good episode. All right. Oreo, do you want to sign us off?
Yes. All right. Thank you guys so much for, man, I'm dark. Hold on. All right, there we go. That's
there we
better.
Go.
Just a little light. I just looked in the camera and I'm like, man, I'm dark. But anyway, thank you guys so much for watching this episode of the Debaterios podcast. Once again, I'm one of your hosts, Oreo.
And I'm your other host, Justin.
And we'll see you guys in the next one.
Woo! Take care, y'all.